It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we discuss steps to avert a freight rail strike in America. A union leading a coalition of more than 115,000 rail workers is in negotiations over better pay, better working conditions. The Biden administration stepped in last month, creating a presidential emergency board to arbitrate and help solve this labor dispute. Join in on railroad workers and labor rights, collective bargaining, and implications on moving freight in America. 800-642-1234. Dennis Pierce is national president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, a union representing over 57,000 railroad workers across the U.S. Dennis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So as you have watched the presidential emergency board step in, tasked with resolving disputes like this, how are negotiations going?
Well, we're at the phase right now where both of the railroads and the unions have made their case to the Presidential Emergency Board, and we're awaiting their recommendations. So right now, there's actually no negotiations going on, although there could be. We don't have a willing partner right now that really wants to talk.
What do you mean by that? You don't have a willing partner that wants to talk?
Well, in any type of contract negotiations, it takes an interest on both sides to come to a fair agreement that the employees would accept. The backbone of all the union contract negotiations is employee or membership ratification. And we are in this position because we've been trying to bargain a contract for 2.5, going on 3 years, and the railroads won't make a proposal that their employees, our members, would accept. So that's what I mean, where we just can't get to a point where there's something out there that we could turn into a contract.
Do you think that the three-person presidential emergency board could be sympathetic and to what the union wants, and perhaps make recommendations in your favor?
It'd be really hard to speculate. Right now, we just have to wait and see what their recommendation will be. The goal of process-wise, the panel, the role they play is to try to make a recommendation that'll get the parties to an agreement, and we'll have to wait and see if that's possible.
Let's talk a little bit about how we got here. You've called the railroads a toxic workplace. Can you elaborate on what's going on?
Yeah, I can. Just to give you a little background, about 5 years ago, most of these Class 1 railroads started reducing their workforce as part of an operating plan called Precision Scheduled Railroading, where they eliminated almost a third of their workforce. This was pre-pandemic. They then tried to force the additional or the remaining employees to do additional work additional shifts. You then had many of these Class 1 railroads adopt attendance policies, at least for engineers and conductors, that forced them to work more shifts or be fired. And that's what I mean by a toxic workplace. When you have to go to work when you're sick and you have to go to work when you're tired or you'll get fired, we find that fairly toxic. Now throw a pandemic into the middle of this. It just makes for a place where people don't want to work. BNSF, one of the carriers that did that, has lost almost 1,000 employees who just said, we're not going to work here anymore. They've got to enjoy what has been called the Great Resignation in railroad land, which was very, very rare prior to this.
What about these issues around the attendance policies, the attendance programs? What happens to workers who have to miss work?
Most of these railroads have adopted point schemes to where you can take so many days off and use points every time you do, varying amounts depending on the day of the week or whether it's a holiday. And at the point that you run out of points, that's when they charge you with a disciplinary event up to and including dismissal in many cases. So it's really hard to plan for the future. The guys we're talking about, just so we also put that in the background, they do not have scheduled days off. They are on call 24/7, 365. They go when they get called. They might be gone 12 hours. They might be gone 50. And when they get back, they expect them in many cases to go back to work in 12 hours with no time with their family other than the time they were at home sleeping. So it's created a lifestyle problem that has made it very difficult for the railroads to either maintain their current employees. And right now they're having a heck of a time even hiring new employees because word is out on the street as to what the job has turned into.
We're talking about work conditions in the freight railroad industry with Dennis Pierce, national president of a railroad union called the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. You can join in on unions railroading this labor dispute that's gone on since 2019, 800-642-1234. Dennis, you know, the union voting overwhelmingly to strike, but can you give us some knowledge about the federal law that gives Congress and the president wide powers to avoid striking union members?
Yeah, the Railway Labor Act is very specific to the unions and the employers that work under it. It was intended to avoid interruptions of commerce, especially when it comes to supply chain issues. So it's right on point with what the whole country is experiencing. The union's goal was never to interrupt the supply chain. The union's goal is to get a contract. That's why we go to the table, we negotiate. Part of the process, once the parties don't think they can get to a voluntary agreement, they enter into mediation. That's a statutory requirement under the Railway Labor Act. We did that. We went through the mediation process with the National Mediation Board, monitoring that, managing that. We were able to convince the mediation board at a certain point that this was, futile, that we were not going to reach an agreement. And that's when they released us. And that started the next steps of the act, which included a 30-day cooling off period. And that's when President Biden stepped in and appointed the Presidential Emergency Board, which interrupts both sides' rights to do self-help for us, which could be a strike, them could be a lockout on the railroad side. And we enter a 30-day period where this panel hears the case and makes a recommendation. Once that recommendation is out, it will start another 30-day cooling off period where the parties will try to meet and see if they can turn that recommendation into a contract.
You are wide apart on wages. What are the sticking points there? Because I think the union has proposed an increase of 31% over 5 years, railroads around 17%.
Yeah, that's with compounding. Our actual proposals, though, theirs was 16, ours was 28.
Okay.
Just some more background on that. These folks have worked, the folks under this contract have worked without a raise since July of 19. So put that on a scale of what they went through. These guys were essential workers during the pandemic. They did not get to work from home. They had to go to work every day. In many cases, that's when these attendance policies were implemented, even though people should have been home when they were sick, they were forced to go to work. So we're over 3 years without a contract raise, inflation as high as it's been in anybody's recent history. And they're frustrated. The railroads have not made a meaningful offer to address these issues. And that's why when you do a strike vote in times like this, you get such a high turnout of people that think it's time to strike to try to resolve this. Strike is a last resort under the Railway Labor Act. It's very rare, as I said, at the end of this 30-day cooling off period, if that's about to begin. If the parties can't turn that into a contract, both parties will get back to the right to self-help. And at that point, it would take Congress to step in and pass a law to resolve this to avoid some other interruption of the supply chain. But the employees are frustrated. I can't share that enough.
Let's say, you know, you get to a new contract. Would raises that would be agreed in a new contract, would they be retroactive to when the old contract expired?
That's our position. Early on, the railroads refused that position. That's really part of what the logjam was about. Time will tell what would be in the ultimate contract. If we get a recommendation that we could turn into a contract, we would certainly insist that it be retroactive. That would be impossible to ratify if it was not.
Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen President Dennis Pierce with us, breaking down the situation of freight rail workers voting to strike, where negotiations are at now. Join in what it's like to work on the railroad, federal law that governs railroad contract negotiations. What's at stake here? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're looking at railroads and unions trying to get a new contract deal, negotiations that have been going on since 2019, and then the Presidential Commission that stepped in to arbitrate last month held hearings in Washington. Recommendations coming soon. The Association of American Railroads estimates in a typical year, freight railroads haul about 2 billion tons of goods. Join in on railroad unions, freight rail workers, quality of life, 800-642-1234. Dennis Pierce is national president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, stays with us. So, Dennis, we've seen the reports that railroads are pushing for one-person train crews on many routes, saying that the second person is no longer necessary with modern technology on trains. How do you feel about that?
I think it's an incredible safety risk. Our union represents primarily at the national table the locomotive engineers. Smart Transportation is the primary representative for the conductors, and our two unions have been working together on these issues, this very issue, for many years. But the railroads have made this a huge sticking point. I personally believe it's partly why we're so far behind in getting a contract settlement, is because some of the Class I railroads are so intent on making that issue part of this negotiating round. But the second set of eyes and ears is imperative on over-the-road freight operations. When you consider that over in my lifetime at the railroads have cut down from 5 employees on a train to 2, they're making record profits with the staffing that they have. This is not a financial necessity. This is just a desire to continue this model of doing more work with fewer employees and eliminating the workforce.
Couldn't it make freight rail more competitive against the future of driverless trucks?
Well, when you consider that the average 10,000 foot, which is short in today's standards for a container train, could have up to 300 containers on it. Each one of those is one truck. So you got to kind of put that on a scale. We've got two guys on this train running 200 to 300 miles per crew, hauling 300 truckloads of cargo. I think that this competition with trucks is completely overblown when it comes to what's actually happening out there. Again, when the railroads report record profits, Union Pacific last year had record profits, best ever. That's 160 some years worth of best ever. So the model that they're doing now is quite profitable. We don't see that this competition argument really warrants creating an unsafe workplace out there by going to a one-man operation.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us from Burlington. Tom, hi, what's your question?
Well, I love railroads. I sit there and wave at the conductor, and sometimes he toots the horn and sometimes he waves. Sometimes he waves like the Queen does. But anyway, in Burlington here, you're talking about safety. We've had 3 accidents here in Burlington, and it's a dangerous situation with the trains. And right now in Burlington, we have the Canadian Northern, which is owned by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, the richest men in the country. But I wanted to ask you, does the Railroad Retirement Board in the United States government have anything to do with negotiating these contracts have anything to do with the negotiation process?
Tom, thank you. Dennis, go ahead.
No, actually, they don't. The Railroad Retirement Board manages the retirement system for railroad employees. And they are completely separate. Obviously, those are legislated rules that govern when railroad employees can retire and such. So those don't really come into the contract negotiations.
Tom Mussel brought up accidents. What do you see there as 30% of railroad jobs were cut in the past 6 years? Are there safety concerns?
I think they're huge safety concerns. We've seen deferred maintenance. Not only did they cut employees, they mothballed locomotives, and they now don't have the employees to bring those locomotives back out and put them online at the pace that their shipments require. On any given day, you've got dozens of trains parked all across the country that either can't be run for lack of a crew because they can't hire, or they got rid of too many employees, or because they don't have locomotives to run the trains. So their responsive time, when you cut, I think, way past muscle or way past fat and you get into muscle and bone, you cannot react to an increase in traffic like this country is seeing right now. So it's self-inflicted, in our opinion.
Yes. Can you go there on the shipping delays that we've seen at the ports and the supply chain bottlenecks that you see on freight railroads? Can you give us some examples of what's going on there and why we're seeing such a bottleneck?
Well, it's just as I said, capacity is an issue, but capacity is even a bigger issue when you have trains sitting still and not moving. And anytime you're short of a crew base, you're not going to run that train. As a result, I think the Surface Transportation Board has stepped in. They've had hearings with shippers who are very frustrated. I grew up in the Midwest. Ag is a huge part of rail shipments, whether it's movement of grain, the products they need to plant. All these things are delayed when trains don't move. So the government's getting involved. I think a lot of people are frustrated with the business model, but the business model was created to make profit. And on that front, it has been hugely successful for both the railroads and their shareholders. So we see them very reluctant to change from this business model. We don't see vast improvement over the last 6 months when the attention started being put to the railroad side of the supply chain. But most of those containers that are out there floating on ships in Los Angeles are destined for a train heading inland towards Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, one of the inland ports. And if those trains aren't rolling, those ships aren't unloading and everything backs up. So they're a huge part of this, but they pretty much self-inflicted this operational change that is parking trains rather than running them.
Dennis Pierce with us, national president of a railroad union called the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, as we look at this labor dispute more closely. And you can join in on your experiences on the railroad, what you think needs to change, what you think about how unions are working with the Presidential Emergency Board, 800-642-1234. We heard from Ross in Crawford County email to say that they're curious about the specific sick leave and time benefits. Could you go into more detail on this? Because, you know, when you look at retired federal workers and you think about the amount of benefits they leave in with health care and sick leave, what are you asking for there?
The one of the things that's important to note is that this is the first time that all 12 of the rail unions have gone in a united fashion in front of a presidential emergency board. We've usually been fairly separated. And the united things that we presented to the board were the wage package, the health care package, and a request for additional sick leave for some, just any sick leave for my membership, and some additional holidays. And part of this, I think, stems from the pandemic. The railroads were not inclined to honor requests for people to be off sick. As I said before, with these attendance policies, they forced people to go to work when they were ill. And all we're trying to do is establish the right for sick employees to stay home. It seems like something most would be used to, but our employees don't have that. My members have no paid sick leave today. The railroad's position is that they should just take their vacation time, which is earned based on how long you've worked there. So young employees have very little. And then they have to go into unpaid status, which also gets them in trouble under their attendance policies. So the goal was to establish something, things we learned from the pandemic, I guess you could call it, that these guys should have access to paid leave when they're ill, because you really don't want them in the workplace if they're sick.
As you step back and look at whether there's a resurgence in unionization across the country, polling says there is. From October to March of last year, union representation petitions filed at the National Labor Relations Board increased 57% from the previous year. What do you think is going on with organizing in America?
I think workers have had enough. I think it's the best way to say it. On the Class I railroads, we are already 85% unionized. We have been probably for the last century. So there's not a lot of room for growth in the Class I railroads. On the railroad side, there is in the short line industry, where the railroads have spun off parts of their operation to smaller railroads. But nationwide, I think you have a growing feeling, especially profitable corporations that won't treat their employees fair, that the right thing to do is join a union. Get together, work together, you're stronger as a group, and unionize. And we're seeing the results of that with improvements to wages, improvements to healthcare. The things that employees used to take for granted from employees or employers, they're now having to fight for day in and day out.
Larry in Kingston. Larry, we're short on time. Your question, go ahead.
Hi. I used to work for the Milwaukee Railroad in the 70s, and the foreman there were the union stewards. Is that the same way it is? Because it seemed in conflict.
Larry, thank you. Dennis.
There are some unions that represent entry-level managers or first layer of management. Our union does not. We are strictly the locomotive engineers and trainmen that operate the trains. So understand the concern, but wouldn't be something that would be an issue for my union.
Dennis, thank you for joining us.
I sure appreciate the time today.
Dennis Pierce, National President of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, a union representing more than 57,000 railroad workers nationwide. Ahead this hour, we explore the question, are unions bouncing back after years of decline? We talk with a labor studies professor and get your take on the status of organizing. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We've been following these reports of unions making a comeback, taking on America's mammoth employers like Amazon, Apple. But is organized labor really in a resurgence? Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics data looking at 2021 says workers belonging to unions continued to decline to 14 million. The membership rate was down slightly as well from 2020. Join in on unions, 800-642-1234. John Logan is here, professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, very happy to be on.
You've been writing about unions and this American union movement underway. What do you see? What do you point to?
Right. Well, I think, you know, with all of these things, it's a complicated mix of factors, but you can really point to two or three different things. One, you know, as your previous guest pointed out, you know, something has changed in the labor landscape as a result of the pandemic. You know, during the pandemic, a lot of the workers that we're seeing try to form unions worked on the front lines. They saw their jobs get more stressful, more difficult, more dangerous, and they didn't feel that they were rewarded adequately or even treated with respect. And so now the idea that, you know, having a voice at the table, having, you know, some say through collective bargaining is definitely resonating with large number of employees. Second, there's no question that a lot of this has been driven by young workers, and you especially, in many cases, young workers with college degrees, but are still finding themselves working in relatively low-paying service sector jobs. And this was true even before the pandemic. You know, if you look at where the sort of energy was in the labor movement, you know, prior to the pandemic, it was things like digital media, it was cultural workers, museum workers, gallery workers, it was nonprofit workers. So again, sectors in which young workers predominate. But that's definitely, again, been heightened as a result of the pandemic. And the third thing is, you know, because we have these successful organizing campaigns at Amazon and Starbucks and, you know, at least one Apple store, these companies have, you know, the American public has a very direct relationship with these companies, much more so than the public ever had with Ford or General Motors in the 30s and 40s, the last time we saw union expansion. And what that means is that they generate enormous both traditional and social media coverage, the union victories at those companies. And that's how young workers find out about them. You know, if you talk to people who are trying to form unions at, say, Trader Joe's, which formed the first union in Massachusetts. There's another election coming up in Minneapolis, actually tomorrow, or at REI, first union in New York City in March. Not only will they say they've heard of the union campaigns at Amazon and Starbucks, but also that they were inspired by them. So, you know, it's partly a sort of combination of those things that resulting in this sort of wave of organizing that we're seeing right now.
It's David versus Goliath type storyline as well.
In many ways, yeah. But go ahead.
We both say there. But, you know, does the federal data tell a different story when you see 10.3% of workers in unions in 2021 tied for the lowest percentage on record? What is the disconnect?
So union density nationally has been declining for years and years, I mean, decades. And, that's caused by a variety of different factors, structural changes in the economy, movement from manufacturing to services. But if you look at it internationally in the US, there's two particular problems. One is a very strong employer opposition. You know, companies like Amazon and Starbucks will do everything they possibly can to try to crush efforts by their workers to form unions. And second is relatively weak legal protection for the right to choose a union. Again, by international standards, the right to choose a union, the legal protections are weaker in the US than they are in most other industrialized democracies. So it's very difficult to form new unions in the United States. So this is why, year by year by year, we've had this decline in union membership. And at the moment, as you say, we have this sort of, apparent disconnect between this sort of unusually hopeful moment, when young workers in particular are very energized and optimistic, many of them. And for the first time ever, we've seen, unions be successful, Amazon or Apple, or, a tremendously successful union drive at Starbucks. But it's not really about the numbers. I mean, when you look at the depth of the crisis of private sector union membership in the United States, private sector, only 6.1% of private sector union members are now unionized. So, so far Starbucks Workers United has won 200 plus elections. You've never been done before in U.S. union history. But even if they won 2,000, it would be meaningless in terms of trying to reverse those decline, the decline in density. But it would be the biggest thing in 100 years in terms of creating this sort of energy and enthusiasm and optimism. But in order to get, millions and millions of new union members, and, we have polling evidence that suggests that 48%, Tom Kokin, a professor of management at MIT, published a study 2 years ago that said that 48% of non-union members in the United States would actually like to have union representation. But realistically, for that to happen, anything like that number to happen, we would need a change in the law. Mm-hmm. We would need to have stronger labor rights.
I want to pause right there as we talk about this uptick in organized labor activity. What is behind it? John Logan giving us that context, studies labor and employment at San Francisco State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. John, what has been the impact of states like Wisconsin passing right-to-work laws in the past decade? Right. What have you seen?
Yeah, so the state, starting, as you said, with Wisconsin in January 2011, after the election of Scott Walker as governor, they basically did two things. A lot of states, that previously had allowed public sector collective bargaining immediately passed laws either prohibiting public sector bargaining or severely restricting public sector bargaining. So again, as had been pointed out, public sector, about 33-34% of employees are union members. It would be much higher if not for state laws that really restrict and in many cases prohibit altogether public sector bargaining. And again, as you said, passing right to work laws, particularly in the upper Midwest, in parts of the country which traditionally have been sort of union strongholds in Wisconsin, but also in Michigan and a variety of other states. There's no question that right to work makes it more difficult, but it's in some ways a sort of symbolic action. It's like planting a flag saying, you know, unions are not welcome here. Mm. You know, when we're talking about public sector, that is purely a political issue. You know, if you have state governments and state lawmakers that allow public sector workers to join unions, then they will join them. If you prohibit it, then, you know, obviously they're not able to engage in collective bargaining. In the private sector, it's more to do with federal law. Hmm. You know, right to work laws, as you said, you know, make a difference at the state level, but it's really more to do with the fact that at the federal level, we have a law that really hasn't been changed in, you know, since the 1930s and 1940s. And it makes it very difficult, you know, the combination of very strong employer opposition and very weak legal protection for the right to choose a union makes it really difficult to form unions at companies like Starbucks and Amazon mm. and Apple. So
what about 4 years ago, the Supreme Court ruling right. on Janus versus AFSCME, and government workers who choose not to join unions may not yeah. be required to help pay for collective bargaining. Sure. What are the effects of that ruling 4 years after it?
Yeah, well, you know, at the time that was viewed as something that might be a sort of game changer. You know, people who were opposed to public sector unions had been pushing for this for a very long time. Actually, in the years since Janus, we haven't seen a huge change hmm. in the membership of those, you know, big public sector unions like AFSCME, like the teachers unions, SEIU has a lot of public sector members. So most public sector workers who were members of unions prior to Janus have chosen to stay members. Hmm. And so it has had an impact on their finances, on the amount of, you know, money coming in, because they're still legally obligated to represent all of the workers. But now, you know, the ones who are not union members don't have to pay these so-called agency fees that contribute to the cost of representing them. But actually, Janus has not made a huge difference. Hmm. You know, as I said, the problem is really just how difficult it is in the public sector, the private sector. Private. And, you know, we have a lot of young workers who are really different, you know, but young workers mostly work in young workplaces, you know, places like Starbucks, Apple stores, REI, Trader Joe's, and young workplaces are overwhelmingly non-union. But they're very receptive to the union message. So if it were easier in the private sector to join unions, I think you would see a huge wave of, you know, places where young workers are sort of concentrated, you know, places like Starbucks, places like Trader Joe's, mm-hmm. like Apple stores, who would want to join unions if they were given, you know, a sort of stronger legal protections, you know,
if the climate was right for
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
San Francisco State University Labor Studies and Employment Professor John Logan is our guide to unions across America, union membership, what he's seen in his research, the impact of right to work laws here in Wisconsin, around the country. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about whether there is this resurgence of organized labor in our country, and if so, what influence the pandemic has had, coupled with that hot labor market that puts more power into the hands of workers. Join in on organizing, negotiations for better working conditions, union busting tactics, what you think is happening to labor in a new generation of workers. 800-642-1234. We have San Francisco State University Labor Studies Professor John Logan, who stays with us. Let's bring in a caller. Lisa is with us from La Crosse. Lisa, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I apologize. I'm not exactly addressing what you said, but I was a semi driver for 10 years, and I'd just like to give my opinion on union drivers. I highly respected them. And as a group, drivers used to frustrate me no end because they would badmouth union drivers, but they were vying for the privilege of driving more for less money, and it made no sense to me. They wanted to drive 80 hours a week instead of 40, and because they could make more money, whereas they were so short-sighted they didn't realize if they had were with the union, they wouldn't have to drive themselves to death.
Lisa, thank you. John, what do you make of those reflections?
Yeah, you know, I think truck driving is like, you know, an occupation that really illustrates the sort of change that unionization, used to be mostly a unionized occupation. It used to be sort of a good job that, you know, where people could enjoy middle class lifestyle and benefits. Then, you know, with the sort of deregulation craze of the 80s, you know, the industry was mostly deunionized. Mm. And then more recently, you know, a lot of truckers have been turned into independent contractors. And, you know, the conditions have really gotten worse and worse. And, you know, the jobs are more precarious, and so, you know, in a way that's sort of contributing to the sort of supply chain problems that we're seeing today with a shortage of people in the industry. But, you know, when I was talking about young workers too, it is related in the sense that these are mostly people who have entered the labor market since the Great Recession of 2008 to 2010. And, you know, they're facing, in many cases, you know, very precarious economic conditions. You know, they're in a labor market where they have jobs. You can't pay off student loans. You can't buy a house. You can't even get a living wage in many of the cities in which they're working. And so, you know, partly this is like a new generation that in some ways has been politicized by, you know, a variety of political and social movements, whether it be, you know, Black Lives Matter or Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns or Me Too, et cetera. But it's also a question of frustrated economic expectations. And, you know, and I think this is part of the reason why young workers, again, according to all of the polling evidence, young workers are very, very pro-union. You know, almost 80% of young workers say they approve of unions, but they have very low rates of union membership for the reasons I said before. They work mostly in non-union sectors.
Along Lisa's line of questioning, though, how strong and powerful are the Teamsters today?
Well, you know, the Teamsters have declined in membership, but mm-hmm. they are still powerful in certain sectors. I mean, UPS is their largest single. You know, they have almost, I think, maybe over 300,000 members. It was always around there, but I think, you know, with the hiring during the pandemic, it may be now over 300,000 members at the Teamsters, and we're seeing them gearing up for contract negotiations, which will take place in 2023, and maybe, you know, a national strike for the first time since 1997 at UPS. But they are also the union that has sort of targeted organizing at Amazon. But, you know, an interesting thing about a lot of the campaigns we're seeing at places like Amazon, places like Trader Joe's, they're actually through independent unions. You know, the union that won at Amazon in Staten Island, the Amazon Labor Union, didn't exist a couple of years ago. Same thing at Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's United is an independent union. And even at Starbucks, Starbucks Workers United is affiliated with an established union. But all of these campaigns are very much driven by this sort of rank and file dynamism, you know, worker organizers, you know, people who work at Starbucks, people who work at Amazon, people who work at Trader Joe's and Apple. They're really sort of organizing themselves, you know, they're engaging in self-organizing. And then in some cases, they're approaching outside unions, established unions. But in other cases, you're forming their own independent unions. I think this will be a trend that will continue.
Let's move to healthcare with Dennis in Green Bay. Dennis, hi, you're a retired union nurse.
Yes, I work in healthcare for 38 years, and most of that time as a nurse, I was in a union, either with the state of Wisconsin or with the Michigan Nurses Association. Those unions help protect nurses in terms of very little forced overtime, regular work hours, regular staffing that we could negotiate so that you weren't working short. So they worked wonderful in terms of help protecting nurses and keeping them in the field. The thing that really changed in Wisconsin was Act 10.
Mm-hmm.
Act 10 attacked the nurses at the university system and stopped them from having bargaining rights. It also attacked the teachers' unions where they can't negotiate wages and that. And now we're faced with teacher shortages because wages haven't kept up. Governor Walker and Clayfish were terrible for this state in terms of keeping teachers in the profession. There's articles on a daily basis.
Dennis, I want to jump in here and allow John to respond specifically in nursing, what you see there in healthcare.
Right. You know, in healthcare, since there were changes in the law in the early 1970s that allowed most healthcare workers to unionize, it's been a sector of the economy where there's been a great expansion of employment, but also nurses in particular, the union message has really resonated with them. I mean, they've joined unions, as have other healthcare workers, in huge numbers. And as the caller was indicating, in the public sector, it really is all down to state politics. So, in states like New York, in Illinois, in Rhode Island, in California, where I'm based, you have like very, very high levels of public sector union membership, because the law allows public sector workers to join unions and to engage in collective bargaining. It's only really in states that prohibit collective bargaining for public sector workers where you see, very low levels of union membership for obvious reasons.
We only have a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, John, what are you studying now? Where does the research on unions center on next?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I think, as I said before, young workers really are kind of taking the lead on this. But also, I think what has been achieved is, if you look at the media coverage, the union issue has really entered the media mainstream and become a matter of general interest. I mean, the very fact that we're talking about it this morning, if you look at the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, on a daily basis, you see stories about union organizing.
They're covering your research field.
Yeah. Well, and this has really never happened. Unions and collective bargaining have always kind of been defined by a parochialism, even in their heyday, that somehow has been overcome. And more people are paying attention to the issue. So we don't know what the legacy of this organizing wave will be. But I do think that, for unions and for workers who want to form unions, there will be some kind of sort of positive legacy of this moment.
Well,
it might not be that Amazon or Starbucks are mostly unionized, but I do think that it won't simply just go up in a puff of smoke. There will be some lasting legacy,
John,
of this moment.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
John Logan, Professor of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University. And now a note about our program. You will hear Shireen Seawert filling in on the morning show. Shireen is host of our regional program, Route 51. Let's welcome her to the mix. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.